All right, folks, we are back on Flagstick.com Teton Podcast, brought to you this week by Adidas Canada and the all-new Code Chaos Footwear. In my studio at home, and Scotty's at his home. Scotty, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay for midweek as we're recording this. Weather's getting a little bit better, starting to think a little bit more about golf, but lots to talk about, that's for sure.
Yeah, and maybe we won't have to be doing all of this in our home. Maybe we'll be able to meet each other on the golf course soon, because golf courses are opening up all over this country. British Columbia opening up, Saskatchewan, Saskatoon.
you wouldn't be the first or last to make an error talking about Saskatchewan, that's for sure.
Yeah, New Brunswick, PEI, pretty much every province but Ontario at this point, though we do expect announcements to come soon, hopefully. What restrictions are you hearing from these different provinces right now when these courses do ultimately open up?
Well, a lot of them have to do mostly with clubhouses being open, just like restaurants. They're not allowing people to gather in that way. And then on the golf courses as well, we're seeing, either some places are saying singles for carts, or only the people that maybe you came with, like the same household or whatever the case may be, no touching flag sticks. They vary from province to province. Some of the provinces themselves have laid down the restrictions. But I'm also hearing there's, adjustments happening as well. So even some of the places that have already opened, they're already saying, okay, maybe this works, maybe this doesn't work, as far as, how much space do we need between people on the driving range. And they're getting approval for those changes with, kind of their local medical health authorities. So it's going to be a work in progress. And we're not guaranteed as well that, everything just goes forward. As long as things are being taken care of properly, then, they will go forward. But certainly they have to look at whatever complications or things come from what they're doing.
For sure. I'm kind of more in line with probably walking a lot more this year, just until this all opens up. Even at that, only people from your own household, only one person in a cart, there's still, how much trust do I have in the 12-year-old kid cleaning the golf cart between myself and the next person, things along those lines? I'm sure they'll be taking all the precautions, but it is something to think about. And we kind of talked in the past about maybe more walkers will come out of this, and I'm sure that will be. I'm wondering, the cup whole thing, like do you just put something in the cup that elevates the ball, so you just kind of pick it up? Do you, raise the cup, so if it hits the cup and stays within a certain circle, that counts as a putt made? I think at this point, a lot of people will, golf's a game of we need traditions, right? And I think at this point, a lot of people out there are just like, just give me anything. I don't care about your tradition. Keep the flag stick in. If I, hit a ball 100 miles per hour and it hits the cup and that counts as a putt, I don't even care, as long as I'm playing golf at this point.
Yeah, I think that's really the case. I tweeted this week. I don't know if you saw that. There was yesterday or the day before. There happened to be an article that was showed up in the Robb Report talking about the pace of play in golf. And I joke that, I'd take a 20-hour round right now, really, just to go outside, be outside, appreciate being out there, being able to play the game. And, obviously, as we talked about a lot last week or whatever, it's a priority. We'd like to get out there and play, but obviously, health matters take precedence over everything.
Now, here's a situation for you. So say you hit a ball over into the woods a little bit, and you see a brand new, a Pro V1 sitting there that's not yours. Do you pick it up now? Like, that's where, I wonder if people are going to be picking up other golf balls. Like, I find a TP5. I was playing a Srixon. Do I pick that up? You know what I mean? I wonder if that will actually help pace of play, if they have new rules around that. Just like, who knows? If they make rules about that, like you can't go searching for balls, just drop a ball wherever. Like, I know what I'm doing. I'm getting my gloves on, I'm getting my masks on. I'm going out at night with seeing eyeglasses or night vision glasses to pick up all these old golf balls. But what was your take? Like, if you're seeing a golf ball,
I guess that's an example of, all the nuances of all the little things that you don't really generally think about or you take for granted, that all of of a sudden you're going to have to put some thought into. And I guess that is kind of where the issue lies for the regulations that are being put into place and how you think about what you're doing and having to think about it, because there's so many things that are just ingrained. And, you know, it's the same right now. You know, you go to the grocery store and, you know, somebody's got a mask on and gloves, but, you know, next thing you know, they're over top of the bananas breathing on them. Yeah. And you know, moving around and doing things that they're normally used to just because it's habit. Mm-hmm. So that's likely to carry over in the golf course as well. So, you know,
oh yeah. Like I got disgusting habits on the golf course. Like where I get on the green, I spit in my hand to clean off my golf ball because I don't want to bring the towel. I can't do that now. Like I don't have fear of doing it, but like, That's going to be, it's frowned upon anyway. Like I'm a disgusting human being for even doing it in the first place, but I mean, it could be worse. I have an uncle that literally puts the golf ball in his mouth. Disgusting.
Oh no, but, not one of those.
Yeah. Just nasty. But yeah. So like it's things like that. Maybe, you know, towel stations, like to get the ball mm-hmm. wet. What does a range look like? Are they cleaning the ball? Like there's so much to think of and we're probably boring everyone out, but I think the positives to take out of here is yes, courses are opening. Hopefully we see that in Ontario. And it seems like more than 50% are open in the United States right now, which is huge.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we're seeing from those course openings, or the biggest positive that we're seeing as far as the Canadian side of it, is that's an indication that you know, the trend is getting better from a health perspective as far as number of people being infected. And I think that's the biggest thing to take into account is you know, the indications that they're opening is because good things are happening. In the States, I don't know. I mean, it's more than 50%, as you said, that are open. Some didn't close. I just saw New Jersey's going to reopen, but you know, related to a lot of other things, people are saying, you know, maybe they just don't have quite the controls in place in some places. So that's a little bit concerning for me, especially in some of the areas. If you're talking about a New York or highly populated areas and their ability to control and do a lot of things. So, you know, I know they're trying to jumpstart the economy, but obviously they have the highest number of cases out there. So I think, you know, precaution is definitely necessary. Yeah. And, you know, we're probably not going to see a lot of travel down to the U.S. We're going to have travel restrictions. And I've talked to a lot of juniors and tournament players in the last week. And, you know, they're obviously not planning to head down to the States anytime soon to play any golf.
No, of course not. And we're talking about our buddy's trip in the fall, and we went to Arizona this year. And say they even open it up, do I want to take a flight somewhere, or do we hop in the car and go to Pinehurst instead and drive for 13-14 hours? These are the changes that will be coming over the next year until we get a solution, a vaccine, a potential cure. Who knows what? I can tell you this, it's not what Trump suggested, that's for sure. Drink Lysol, folks.
Yeah. You know, that sort of plays into it too, in talking about the courses and the places that are opening. You know, we're going to get to it here a little bit. Of the LPGA is obviously came out with another renovated schedule, pushing it back a little bit more to a mid-July start. But even within that statement, Commissioner Mike Wan basically said that, you know, the three states where they're planning to start, which are, you know, New Jersey, Ohio, and Michigan, they've got to see a little bit more progress there in the fact of, you know, the cases and them, you know, being reduced more and seeing better things there before they can host those events. So, you know, that plays into exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. And I think that's the difference between golf and the other sports that are talking about coming back. And now there's a lot of safety things that do happen within golf, and there's a lot of distance, and you don't need to be beside your partners, or there's no contact with the players you're playing against. The thing about playing basketball, hockey, football, for example, the dimensions of the field don't change. So you could actually just play on one field, have all the players in, say, in this crazy hypothetical world of they all stay in their own hotel and every game's played in this stadium and they are able to clean it all down afterwards. Like, you know, it's insane to think, but let's say that. Where golf, you can't do that because you can't just play the same course over and over for weeks on end because, you know, certain courses suit certain people's eyes and, you know, yada, yada, yada. It just wouldn't work that way. So I understand, you know, when Mike's saying that, the commissioner of the LPGA saying that, like, these places need to see some improvements, it's because, like, we need to be going to different golf courses. We can't just, you know, go to Sawgrass for 8 weeks in a row.
Yeah, and you know, they've obviously got a situation there where they've got some other tournaments that have you know, been canceled. They're thankful at least that in working with some of their sponsors, some of the sponsors for some of the events that have canceled have actually put money in to help support the events that are actually going to happen. So it's kind of neat to see. Actually, we're seeing increased purses for a number of events that they've got proposed, and that's based on the money coming from other sponsors. So that's pretty incredible, really, for the LPGA Tour to have that relationship with those sponsors, and for those sponsors to be willing to give money to events that are not their events. So you know, it's important you know, for these events to travel around, take care of those communities that they're involved in, which is a big part of it as well.
Absolutely. And with all this, they've also announced that the Olympic qualifying for the Olympics that would have been taking place this year in Tokyo is now taking place next year in 2021. So that means the qualifying needs to be extended. Both of those have been extended to June of 2021 for both the men and the women, which is good. And now Dustin Johnson has almost a full year to come up with an excuse of why he won't be playing next Olympics, just like he did this one and the previous one.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that was to be expected. And basically now nothing's changed. Still 60 player field on both sides. And they just now have a more extended window to qualify. And that's unfortunate, really, for the players that, you know, were pretty close to qualifying this year. But, you know, we're all in the same boat and they're all in the same boat. So, I mean, it's just that's the way it is. And, you know, they've got another year to work on it, whether that's their game or their excuses.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're talking about all these postponements and delays of things, but we keep talking about it. There is golf being played still professionally. The Outlaw Tour is still being played, and a PGA Tour member is playing in events. Alex Sejka, I think that's how it says.
It's Chayka,
whatever. I don't think, you know what? He doesn't even deserve his last name spelled said right, let alone spelt right. Not that I, you know, have the easiest last name to spell or say. I digress. He won another Outlaw Tour event.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to get sick of this. I think this is an embarrassment for Mr. Alex Sejka, whatever, however you say his name. And I mean, I get it. He has the right to play in these events, but let me just go over some numbers here of this guy's career earnings. He's won over $12 million US on the PGA Tour. He has $100,000 this year alone in the bank. In his career, won over $450,000 on the Korn Ferry Tour. He's won over 4 million euros out on the European Tour. I'd even look up at his Challenge Tour stats. He's probably won a million there. We're talking 17 million plus in US dollars across those three tours. And here he is taking money out of pockets of these pros that this is the only place they play. That's my take. It seems like you have a different take on it. I don't agree with it.
Yeah, you got to remember, this is a guy who's not exactly on the rise in his career. This is a guy later on in his career. Most of those earnings that he's had were earlier on. They haven't been in the last bunch of years. That said, you know what? It's pro golf. It doesn't matter if Jack Nicklaus shows up or, you know, Tiger Woods shows up. I mean, that's who you got to play against. Fair is fair. There's not a, you know, some sort of rule that says, oh, because you're this level player, you can't come play here. And these guys need reps. They want to play. You're going to see it this week, the West Florida Tour, number 39 in the world. So think about this. Alex Chayka, I don't know where his world rankings are, but they're certainly not in that stratosphere. But world number 39, Jazz Jenna Watanand, is going to be playing on the West Florida Tour in an upcoming event. And again, just trying to get ready, trying to get his game ready. And, you know, you're a professional athlete and away you go. So, you know, although, yes, I guess from a PR standpoint, some people are kind of, you know, complaining a little bit about Chayka playing, but it's not like he's walking away with these events and he still has to go out and score and win the tournament.
Yeah, that's fair. But I think I'm going to just agree to disagree on this one. I think, you know, yes, he may have won that $17 million across, you know, the last 20 years, right? I mean, I think he turned pro in what, 1989 or something like that.
Yeah.
I get that. $17 million is more than any, you know, many people make in a lifetime, let alone, you know, a 20-year span or whatever it is. And, you know, I disagree with it. I think, you know, I don't know what's going on in Alex's life. Maybe he's got a bunch of outstanding debts he's got to pay. Who knows, right? I still don't think it looks good. And, you know, yeah. I think he can wait till the PGA Tour comes back. But, hey, what do I know? I think we can move on. And maybe what he should be doing is doing like the rest of us and watching The Last Dance on Netflix. Have you been watching this? Now, this is just to clarify for anyone wondering. That is the documentary on Michael Jordan and the Bulls, their last season together, the 1998 season. Have you started watching this, Scotty? Because I'm loving it.
I have, and I love this type of thing. I mean, I love documentaries as it is. And the neat part about this one is the fact that, you know, it's 20 years in the making. I mean, a lot of the footage and everything is from back then. It's not about a retrospective just now. It's a case of they were working on the project back then, and then they had the foresight to be doing that, knowing that, you know, they were going to get something out of it in the future. Didn't know probably it was going to be 20 some odd years before that it would actually come out. But yeah, it's been fascinating just to see kind of some of the details that come to the surface and that you see that wouldn't have been able to be sort of put out there back in the day or within a couple of years of, you know, when Jordan was really still playing, right?
Well, I remember when the preview came out for this. I think it was a Super Bowl 2 years ago when they showed the preview for this, and I was like, fast forward, let's go. That's the basketball.
Let me get to it right now.
Yeah, that's the basketball I loved is that yeah. late 90s, early 2000s. I get why it's played the way it is. But to bring it to a golf angle, imagine they did this with Tiger. I think Tiger's the guy you're going to have to do it with to make it work. Like, there's just so many stories about Tiger. You know, anything from the injuries to, you know, the things going on in his personal life to being arguably one of, if not the best player, the second best player of all time. I think if you could somehow get him to commit to do it fully, no PR nonsense. That's the thing, though, as you kind of touched on, it has to be at the right time. So it's not when he's playing, you're not going to get it. Maybe it needs to be, you know, 10, 15 years from now, you might get something like this when his kids are old enough to hear these stories and things along those lines. That I would pay disgusting amount of money to see that. And we know there's footage out there. Like, this guy's had a camera in his face his whole life.
Yeah, you've got to think that there's some projects underway here and there. The thing that's got to happen, and it's just like what's happening right now for The Last Dance, is you've got to get far enough away from the situation that there's not a lot of implications for people. So for an example, you know, maybe it's a manager, a caddy, other players, you know, agents, sponsors, people involved in tournaments. I mean, they're not going to talk now because there's implications of what they're doing and it impacts what their business is going to be doing and everything else that goes around with it. So they'll talk 20 years from now and they'll go on record, but people are just not going to go on record right now. And I can tell you, even from a media side of it, you know, there's lots of people within the media that would have lots of stories and details, but, you know, they know that all of a sudden if they jump out and put those out there, maybe they're not something that's really necessary from a journalism standpoint, but maybe it's a tidbit or a nugget or something that they knew happened or an event that, you know, could play into this. They're not going to talk about that at this point until maybe they're retired and write about it later on. And Tiger himself is obviously, you know, not going to do that. Even if you see the books and things that come out right now, even from his own, you know, side of things, it's still going to be very reserved at this point.
Yeah. And I think the history proves that writing a book about Tiger and the stories, your personal stories with him, doesn't usually work out in your favor. Has he ever seen Hank Haney on a driving range since? Nope. Like, no one's working with him.
Yeah.
I mean, there's other reasons for that and some idiotic comments he's made since, and he hasn't helped himself. But, you know, like, you look at, you know, Stevie Williams, for example, like, there was almost like a little bit of a black ball for him for a bit. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Adam Scott said, screw your black ball, we're going out to win some the Masters together. You know, like, it's weird. Like, I think there's that fear of Tiger and what his control over things is. You know, it might seem crazy, but it does exist. And the golf industry is a small industry.
Well, I think the juggle here now for a lot of people is that, you know, Haney, for an example, probably gets offered a big amount of money to do that project, but he gets offered that money now. You know, he could have done that book in 20 years from now, but he's thinking, man, I've got the opportunity right now. And I shouldn't say he's thinking, I don't know that for in particular, you know, that's the truth. But 20 years from now, you know, he may get offered some money, but it may not be as much, or there might not be a taste, or somebody else at that point might have done something. So I think that's just, you know, being opportunistic more than anything. But I think you're right. The documentary side of this, showing all the little pieces that went into, you know, winning those championships for the Bulls, is very much like what could happen for Tiger Woods, and all the little pieces that go into winning, you know, at this point, 15 majors. You know, it'd be very, very interesting to see a well put together documentary at that point later on.
And you know, if he gets, say he picks up one this year or two in the next 3 years, just say that, right? You know, these things are coming, because if The Last Dance is getting as much, you know, publicity and as much love as it is, you know, they're going to try to do the same thing, the chase for 18 or whatever it is, right?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
It's going to happen. And I can't wait. I hope it does. It's like, if you're asking me of all things sports wise, what's the one documentary I want? It's that. Maybe John Daly, a close second. I think that would be an interesting one. Let's move on from that. A couple other things we're going to get into before we get into our interview this week with Scott Pritchard, who just was the newly named executive director for the McKenzie Tour. And we're going to talk all things McKenzie Tour and a little bit of the PGA Tour. But before we do, I want to get your thoughts on Nick Faldo's thoughts on making drivers smaller and taking away tees, both of which are interesting thoughts. And I'll give his quotes a quick read here. So in terms of making the drivers smaller, he said, if we brought the size of the face down, so there were some serious mishits, so the sweet spot for the pro is a real sweet spot, not a sweet face. That's what it is now. It's the whole thing. That is an awful quote, for the record. Like, kind of keep it together here. So let's talk about the smaller drivers. Do you really think that would be that big of a deal?
No, I don't. I mean, I know they've had an impact on the game. Obviously, for players, you know, you can mishit them a little bit more than you could previous ones. And I'm a person that's bridged both eras, whether it's, you know, persimmon, metal woods to, you know, oversized 460cc drivers. The thing is, the most skilled players in the world will find a way to get it done. Yeah, I mean, Greg Norman
still be the most skilled players in the world.
Exactly. So the only thing I see with this is that it's going to punish the average golfer. So if you're talking about, you know, if it's just tour only, I don't think it has that much of an effect, because it'll be the same, you know, for everyone. They'll adapt and whatever. I don't know what you're trying to accomplish. Maybe he's thinking that it's just going to make it that much better as far as golf courses or whatever.
And what does that help from an entertainment perspective? It doesn't.
It doesn't.
You know, at the end of the day, people are just going to be making things up. Like, oh, I hit one 300 drive. Well, Rory hits one 300 drive. And you know that sweet spot on, like, you know, like that. Yeah. That's the nonsense. Like, you don't need that. I don't get that. And then his second thing, which
with the tees.
So he just before I preface, he starts it great, and then he just makes his argument against exactly why this is a terrible argument. But he says, the other simpler way is saying, if we banned tee pegs, if they went and played a tournament with no tee pegs, right? Well, the guys would have to alter their driver. You'd be allowed to place it on the grass. Now, they won't be using drivers that are 6 degrees. They don't use drivers. It doesn't matter. They'd say, okay, I need 9 degrees. I need 10. I need one that's going to get airborne a bit and get a bit of give in the face. That would seriously change it. Sure, they could hit a 3-wood. That would actually be your optimum. So, like, I'm not going to go into this further about where it is. Exactly. They would just hit 3-wood. Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy, Martin Trainer hit it over a green from 300 yards out with a 3-wood. It's not going to change anything.
No, it takes out the potential for certain factors, but you've got to understand that, you know, that would just make the manufacturers and the players start to adapt the 3-woods that more. So that much more. So they're all of a sudden going to, you know, optimize their lofts. Yes, they're not going to be able to hit up, because obviously the ball is on the ground. But they're still going to put themselves in a situation that they're going to maximize their distance. And just as you said,
you know, I know players that can carry a three with 300 yards now because of the trampoline effect on the face. They're optimized. They get the right loft on there, the right launch angle, and they end up with launch numbers that are basically driver numbers with a three wood. So well-intentioned. I highly respect them as a golf champion, but I don't think it's really going to change that much. And really, I mean, are the paying golf spectator going to go watch a lot of tour pros hit three woods off the tee?
No, it's silly. It's a silly take. It just seems like something just to talk. I mean, I'm sure Nick's just bored like the rest of us and just wants to talk some golf. And that's probably where that came from. It does, as I said, he does go and basically ruin his argument or refute his own argument there with the three wood talk. But, you know, I digress. Thought it was a funny thing to bring up on the podcast.
For sure.
Why don't we head over to our interview, Scott? Another Scott, as I mentioned. Why don't you give us a quick rundown of Scott's career and what we're going to be talking with him about?
Yeah, Scott Pritchard, as you mentioned, is the newly named executive director of the Mackenzie Tour, PGA Tour Canada. He's been working for the tour for almost a decade now. Previous to that, he had worked for the PGA of Canada. So well-known in the golf industry and certainly paid his dues with the Canadian circuit. And he certainly is going to tell us a little bit about what's happening with the tour. And we really appreciate, you know, him spending the time with us for sure.
This episode is brought to you by Adidas and the all-new Code Chaos footwear. Chaos lives here, so you must expect the unexpected and harness chaos. Break free of tradition and drive yourself. Inspire your game with the high-performance design of the Tour Performance Spikeless Adidas Code Chaos golf shoes. Every step is light and energized, each swing secure and confident. Experience Chaos Traction and Twist Grip Hybrid Spikeless Outsole. Chaos is here. Visit adidas.ca to learn more about the all-new Code Chaos footwear.
All right, we want to welcome to the podcast the new executive director of the Mackenzie Tour, PGA Tour Canada, longtime friend, and glad to see him in this position now. Scott Pritchard, welcome to Tee Talk.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Obviously, a different time for a lot of professional tours, a lot of professional sports. So why don't you give it to us from your perspective as far as how you got the news about PGA Tour and basically all the tours shutting down and how that affected you immediately?
Yeah, so I was actually at the Players, and obviously it was a fluid situation. I kind of knew, I mean, we didn't really know what the extent of it would be at that time. And I flew down there under the premise that everything was going to be okay, which I think a lot of people were just going about their travel. You know, March break was in and around that same time. And I think it was the seminal moment in this entire situation that I believe it was March 11th, Sophie Trudeau, Tom Hanks, the basketball player, Rudy Gobert, I think his name is. And that was when I was watching CNN in my hotel room. I was like, man, this isn't good. And then got to the golf course on Thursday and, you know, started to hear rumors about, you know, we're going to play without fans on Friday. And then that got announced. And then I was, when that got announced, I actually changed my travel plans and flew back on the Friday morning. I was going to come back on Saturday. And then obviously Friday morning, the commissioner had his press conference and announced that the Players was canceled. And then we obviously followed suit.
So now as we look at it, you know, you're obviously trying to make some adjustments. There's a lot of planning that has to be done. What kind of update can you give us at this point? I mean, obviously the tour has postponed the first six events of the year. Probably not in a position at this point to kind of nail down all your plans, but what's the kind of update for anybody who hasn't listened and heard about it yet?
Yeah, so we're working with all of our partners and golf courses across Canada to try and reschedule events where we can. You know, we're going to run into a situation where we just don't have enough weeks as it relates to weather, daylight, that kind of stuff. So we're working and looking at a bunch of different models, Scott, in terms of what the season could look like. We're also waiting to hear more details in terms of what the PGA Tour is going to do with the season. And we should be seeing an announcement on that front in the coming days, how that's going to impact the Korn Ferry Tour and then ultimately how it's going to impact our tour. So there's still a lot of moving pieces. I'm sure everyone's getting used to the term fluid situation, and that's what we're in. But with the information that we have available to us, we do have a schedule in place that we, should we get the proper clearance from the health authorities, be it provincial, municipal, federal, we do have a plan in place to have a season. It's not going to be 13 events, but our hope is that we'll be able to have as many events as we can. The fly in the ointment a little bit for us is the fact that we still need to conduct 4 Q schools. And so we've also got a plan for that. It's likely that we'll run 4 Q schools in a span of 2 weeks. So 2 concurrently each week. We have a plan for that. We're just waiting on confirmation for golf courses, but I'm not really worried about that at this point. I'm pretty sure we'll have no problem to find facilities to do that. And we have, for the most part, we have them lined up. We're just, again, waiting for sort of get the contract signed.
You talk about having a plan. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure the plan changes every single day. And when we move down another day, a new plan is created, and another month, another plan is created. And it's almost impossible. Yeah. Just like everyone dealing out there is, plans, they look nice on paper right now, but they can quickly get torn up and have to rewrite a new one.
Indeed. We've got spreadsheets upon spreadsheets of various plans, and I actually started tracking them in different scenarios. And I think we're in week 7, and I'm in scenario 7 right now. So it's literally changed each week. And it's just based on information that you're getting from partners, whether or not we can move events from 1 week to another week. Are the courses, do they have that week available? And then you're also dealing with factors in terms of sponsorship. Is the money there? So we're reviewing budgets, we're reviewing dates, and, you know, even courses, well, we have weddings, but we're not sure if gatherings are going to be able to take place. And so there's all these factors that you have to deal with. But for the most part, like I said earlier, I think we have a plan in place. Again, if we get the green light at some point, I'm often asked, like, do we have a drop dead date? Right now, we don't necessarily have a drop dead date because we're waiting to see what happens. We're going to hold out as long as we can, but I can tell you that our tournaments have been tremendous in the sense that they're like, yeah, we'll follow your lead. We're ready to go if we're given enough time. Certainly, we don't want to say to a tournament, okay, we have 2 weeks, like, let's go. So that's going to change things. But yeah, there's probably more scenarios to come, Stefan.
Yeah. It's funny though. They say, you know, all those years you've spent on the Canadian tour prepared you for this, but I don't think anything can prepare you for something like this. This isn't in the manual, in your training manual, when you become the executive director of the Mackenzie Tour, I don't think.
No, not definitely not. But I will say two things on that. One is that Jeff Monday, the former president of the Mackenzie Tour, he actually sent me a text last Friday when it was announced about my promotion. And he said, good luck. And I, you know, this is obviously a tough time, but I know you'll do well. And I said to Jeff, you know, whether I knew it or not at the time, you taught me a lot. And a lot of the things that you taught me, I'm dealing with now. And he sent me a nice text back. He said, well, you were a good student. And so to be fair on that first point is that, yeah, I mean, there's certainly not a playbook. But on the second point, we, as a staff and as a tour, we have great relationships with all of our constituents, our players, our partners, our golf courses, our tournament directors, host organizations. And so if it wasn't for that, we'd be in a real predicament. But because we have such a strong relationship with those various stakeholders, it's allowed us the flexibility to be able to maneuver in this uncertain time.
Now, you're one of the few, if not the only employee to have worked on the pre-PGA Tour Canadian Tour that's still there. Mm-hmm. What do you think the major advantages of it? I mean, they're pretty obvious, but you know, if the Canadian Tour was just the Canadian Tour and having to deal with this situation now versus being under the PGA Tour umbrella, obviously this is a massive resource to be able to have for this tour, right?
Yeah. And I'll say this because he'll be upset if I don't mention it, but Randy Korn and I are the only two remaining employees. But yeah, I mean, quite honestly, if it was the Canadian tour still, I'm not sure we'd be sitting here. But certainly the resources for sure. I mean, it boils down to the fact that we've built this tour since 2013 into one of the most competitive tours in the world. And we've built a brand that players and sponsors and partners want to be involved with. Mackenzie Investments as an example, Canada Life as an example, ATB, the list goes on. And had we not had the financial support from those corporations and others, yeah, certainly we wouldn't be in this position. So it obviously helps with having the PGA Tour brand behind you. And the fact that we've had such good success with our players in graduating not only to the Korn Ferry Tour, but ultimately to the PGA Tour, and that all of those factors have really helped solidify this tour, as I said, as one of the top, if not the top developmental tour in the world.
Yeah, and I think that's where we should take the conversation, all the positives that this tour does do. And for me, it's I think one area that we like to touch on a lot is the caddies. We're a big pro caddy podcast. And that was where I got my first start as a caddy. How important is the caddy program that you do and at every event? I know you it's not every detail you can go over. You can go over, you teach them how to rake. It's right back to the basics. And I think it started a lot of careers for caddies across the world.
Yeah, it has. You know, I was saying to Brendan Stazowicz, who's our media official, I said, we should start a story, like a series of stories called Caddy Chronicles or something like that. And the reason I say that is over the years, I talk to people and they're like, oh, I caddied on the Canadian Tour. And Kyle Dubas is one. A really funny story is Brad Jacobs, Olympic gold medalist curler. I had the opportunity to meet Brad at a tourism Sault Ste. Marie function and the whole curling team. And Jeff Dykeman, who's a mutual friend of ours, he used to work up at Crimson Ridge in Sault Ste. Marie. And Ryan Harnadin, I screwed his last name up, but Ryan on Brad's team worked for Jeff, as did Kyle Dubas, which is kind of funny. But anyway, so I met Brad and we were talking. He's like, oh, you work for the tour. He's like, that's cool. He's like, I caddied in the Northern Ontario Open in like whenever 2007 or something. And I was like, oh yeah, who'd you caddy for? He's like, I caddied for Derek Gillespie. I was like, man, that is awesome. I'm like, you know, we're having an event. This was our first year of Thunder Bay. I'm like, we're having an event in Thunder Bay. I'm like, you should come up and play in the Pro-Am with Derek. That would be hilarious. And he's like, yeah, I'm in for sure. So unfortunately, Derek's father passed away around the same time. So Derek wasn't able to come up. But Brad did come and played in the Pro-Am and had a blast. His team actually won the Pro-Am. And if anyone knows Brad, he had a great time. And there's other stories. Mark Chipman, for example, the owner of the Winnipeg Jets. I was in Winnipeg earlier this year when we announced the new name for the event in Winnipeg called the Manitoba Open. And Mark pulled me aside and it said, you know, I caddied on the Canadian Tour. And so the Canadian Tour and Mackenzie Tour, quite honestly, is responsible for some pretty hefty accomplishments in the world of Canadian sports.
Right on that same vein, you know, obviously the tour connects the communities, the athletes, everybody being involved. I don't think a lot of people really appreciate the charitable aspect of the tour and its impact, especially in Canada and the communities. And, you know, they always seem to think of the events about, you know, they think about the players, they think about the golf course, and that's about it. But, you know, from your perspective, you know, tell us a little bit about that impact and maybe where you guys are trying to go with it.
Yeah. So when the Canadian tour never really had a charity component to the tour. And as you guys know, the PGA tour is really all about charity. And so when we started the Mackenzie tour, it was really about, we got to focus on the community first and foremost. And what does that mean? And charity is a large component of that. And so since we started in 2013, we've raised over $5 million for local charities all across the country, and really have impacted lives. And in terms of what we're trying to do on the charity side, we're really trying to tell those stories, Scott. So it's not about, hey, like give them the check and then we leave town and we don't really hear about where that money went, what it did to help the community. And there's some really good stories out there. One of them in particular is with in London at the Thames Valley Children's Hospital. The money that the Canada Life Championship has raised for Thames Valley has actually gone into purchasing fitness equipment in the rehab facility. And a couple of years back, Albin Choi, when he played on the tour, and Mackenzie Hughes actually went to Thames Valley and did a small workout on the equipment and worked with some of the children in the hospital. And that was a really touching moment. You know, when we had the event in Kingston area at Loyalist, we went to the regional hospital out there and brought players. So we're trying to do that, but not just bring the players, but actually document what's happening. And so that's a real a key component of our overall media strategy, I'll call it, for this year, is to really get in there and find the stories, find the people that have been impacted by this positively, and share those stories.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, charities, why we do this, but you know, the stories of the players is something that's obviously dear to your heart as well. And watching these guys graduate onto the big tours, I'm sure brings you some sort of pride and joy. Is there a certain story, a certain player that you look back on, and anytime you see them on TV, it just makes you proud to know they came through the Mackenzie tour?
You know, definitely. And one player that you guys will laugh, because I'm sure whenever we see him, we kind of chuckle, is Joel Damon comes to mind. Joel is a hilarious guy. And if you recall, Scott, on the old Canadian tour, I used to do the Canadian Tour TV where I'd interview the players.
Yep.
And Joel, it was actually his first event back after beating testicular cancer. And he came back and Joel goes low. Like this guy, they used to call him like Scuba Steve. That was a joke because he'd go so low and, or deep. And so I interviewed Joel and I was a total marble mouth. And I'm like, okay, take one, take two, like five, six takes. Joel sent me a text on Saturday morning. He's like, dude, I remember you on the Canadian tour, like fumbling with your microphone and marbles in your mouth. He's like, congratulations. So, you know, you really develop friendships with these players, and you know, I'm very fortunate in that regard. You know, guys like Adam Hadwin and Nick Taylor, Roger Sloan, you know, a lot of the Canadian guys are good friends, and you know, have always been very supportive of the tour and me, but more so the tour. So I mean, we've had 41 players that have made it to the PGA Tour, and I really enjoy when I get to go to the RBC Canadian Open or the players and seeing them in that environment. You know, you do definitely take, you have a bit of pride in the fact that you played a small role in their journey to make it to the PGA Tour.
Now I'm seeing the, you know, the schedule for this year. Like you said, it's not going to be 13, but one thing that was projected for the schedule this year was a return to some certain markets, Prince Edward Island, for an example, mm-hmm. Taking the tour back to the US for events. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit of why maybe you guys decided to dip back down into the US for a regular tour event?
Yeah. I mean, there's a few reasons for that, Scott. I think the first and foremost is, we want to expand the tour and add playing opportunities for our members. And there's only a certain number of markets in Canada that we can hold events in. And secondly, a large number of our players are Americans and or based in America. And so we had an opportunity This event in Brainerd was, they were trying to get a Corn Ferry Tour event. They reached out to the Corn Ferry Tour to, they're actually having like what they called a showcase event. And it was essentially just like a mini tour event where, you know, players paid an entry fee and they had some sponsorship and they played for it. And the Corn Ferry Tour reached out to us and said, hey, like, we don't really have a date for these guys. If you're interested in talking to them, we'll facilitate an introduction. Next thing we know, we're in Winnipeg and the tournament director came up to Winnipeg. We had a really good conversation with him there. And then in October of last year, I went down to Brainerd in Minnesota. It's kind of, Brainerd's like kind of like our Muskoka, mm-hmm. Cottage country, really beautiful. And I met with the team at Craigan's Resort, which is an unbelievable resort, like huge. I couldn't believe it. It was unbelievable. And they have everything there, including two great golf courses. And we began the discussion then, and they had a title sponsor already lined up. We met with the title sponsor, and lo and behold, a few months later, we had a deal. So those events typically don't come together that quickly. But that was really the impetus to add that event. And, you know, I don't think we'll add many more US events. We're open to it, but we've said from the beginning that this tour is a Canadian based tour and we don't intend to move away from that.
Minnesota's kind of like Canada anyway, right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Makes sense.
Southern Canada.
It pretty much is. As well, you know, I mentioned that, you know, talking about Prince Edward Island, you know, it's nice to be able to go back into that market. Mm-hmm. They just got the news today that golf can return there as of May 1st. You know, what's your excitement level to go back to Eastern Canada? I know you spent a fair amount of time in Atlantic Canada, whether it was working when you were working with the PGA of Canada, but mm-hmm. and with working with the tour as well. But how exciting is it to dive back into that market?
Yeah, I would say out of all the events this year, I'm probably most excited for PEI. One of the main reasons is the people in Atlantic Canada. I know you Scott, are biased there as well.
A little bit.
But yeah, but really the people are outstanding and our players are treated so well. I mean, they're treated well across the country, but everyone knows about the Atlantic Maritime or hospitality. And I built some very good friendships on PEI and throughout the Maritimes. Secondly, I'm really excited about playing Dunderave. I think that that course is going to provide an amazing test for these players. I've said, quote, formidable test. And I really believe that. Having played it myself and blowing my brains out, I'm eager to see, not that I can compare it to these guys, but I'm just, you know, one of the major, I would say players often from week to week are shooting numbers that are unbelievable. Like I think last year we had two or three events where it was between 26 and 28 under. And so I think you would agree with me under the right conditions. I see Dunderave as a potentially, you know, 9, 10, maybe 12, 13 under, but I don't see it going much lower than that. Especially if it's playing the way it should play.
Yeah, you can get stuck in some of those bunkers and be in there for a while. I know, I think I've spent a whole vacation in that big bunker in the front of 18. That's for sure. So, yeah. And, you know, there'll be great hosts down there. And I think, you know, being in those communities is really important because, you know, they're a smaller population and you guys get to be the big show in town versus, you know, going to a major city where you, you know, you might not get the same amount of media attention as you would there, right?
I totally agree. And Golf PEI, Mark McLean and the team there have been awesome to work with. And we had a relationship with Golf PEI for many years. And we have been talking to PEI for a number of years. So we're fortunate that we were able to partner with Sports and Entertainment Atlantic. They have a great relationship with PEI, with Golf PEI as well. So to see that come to fruition, and to your point, I really believe that Charlottetown in particular and the surrounding area, I mean, I think the joke on PEI is everything's 20 minutes away. I really think, you know, under normal circumstances, if we weren't necessarily dealing with COVID, you know, I'm willing to bet that the community is really going to rally around it. And we're excited about that.
We talked a little bit about some players before. Is there somebody that's out on the tour that maybe didn't, you know, move on in the last couple years that you think is going to be kind of a next breakout player?
You know, that those are always hard ones to predict, Scott. And I'm not trying to avoid the question by any sure. means.
Yeah.
But if you look at from year to year, the number of players like Dan McCarthy is a good example of someone that played the Canadian Tour with limited success, you know, went back to Florida for a couple years, played the mini tours, did really well on those tours. And then lo and behold, came up to our tour in 2016 and won four times. So there's always players that are going to break out as it relates to, you know, from season to season. So it's really hard to predict. These players are so good. I mean, look, Jake Knapp is another really good example. Jake played our tour in 2017 and 18, lost his card, went back to Q School, and then lo and behold, last year won two events. Paul Barjon, he's another good example. I mean, even Taylor, the list goes on. Taylor Pendrith,
yeah.
You know, had an amazing year last year and got off to a slow start and had a chance to win. So, it's really hard to predict that, but I anticipate this season, like others, to be as competitive as they have been in recent years.
I mean, at this point, Alex Sejka might show up and start playing events. No event he won't play at this point.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the thing for a lot of these players. I mean, people don't really appreciate how good they are, and maybe they don't respect, you know, that talent level. I mean, we go back when we were talking about the Great Waterway Classic. I remember Tony Finau playing at Upper Canada Village, and, you know, people going, oh, this guy's great and whatever, but probably not expecting that, you know, he's going to be one of the top players in the world within a few years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you think about the numbers, we have 41 players that have made it to the PGA Tour. Of the 41 players, you've had 8 victories. And one of the cool stats with those victories is if you take Nick Taylor as an example. So Nick was the first Mackenzie Tour alum to win on the PGA Tour. And he did it 14 months removed from playing on this tour. And Mackenzie Hughes did it similar. His last event was in September of 2015. He won on the PGA Tour in November of 2016. So these guys are so good. Jeff Monday has an analogy that he uses, and I steal it now too. But his point was that if you took 10 PGA Tour players, 10 Korn Ferry Tour players, and 10 Mackenzie Tour players, and you watched them on the range and you couldn't see their faces, you couldn't tell the difference. And people then say, well, what is the difference? And really what the difference is in my mind is that this tour is a platform for these players to come up and learn how to be a professional, learn how to travel, learn how to manage their time, which is really important. And if they, you know, booking hotel rooms, all those sorts of things, dealing with the media, dealing with volunteers, dealing with crowds inside the ropes, walking with caddies, as you guys well know. And if I believe the guys that learn that the quickest, so they all can play golf. It's really about learning all the other intangibles. And once the guys pick up those, they're going to move on. And really that's what we're here for. That's what this tour is here for, is to provide them that opportunity to hone their game and get on to the Korn Ferry Tour and then ultimately onto the PGA Tour.
I'm sure there's many guys that have gotten to the Mackenzie Tour, have all the talent in the world. And it's all those other things you talk about that just couldn't get them over the edge. Maybe they're just not made to be on the road all year long. That's a whole other thing to get bought, you know, get over, right? And it's obviously different on the Mackenzie Tour, being that some of these guys are living in a van even just to save some money, but it's still life on the road that you have to teach yourself. And who knows the stories out there of the great player that could have made it that just couldn't get past those little things that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a long list of those players, and a couple, you know, one that comes to mind, and hopefully he doesn't mind me speaking about him, but Mike Maisy, who is one of the top Canadian, I think he was the top rated junior player in the country. He almost won the Canadian Amateur out in New Brunswick, I believe, at Edmundston. Is that the right Edmundston Golf Club?
Could be, yeah.
It's where Tony Dunn's dad Tony was Dunn. The pro there for a long time. And Mike actually lost to Dillard Pruitt in the final. It was match play at that time. But so Mike had a pro career for, I'm going to say, 7 years. He won the Manitoba Open. Really good player. And he just realized at a certain point, he's like, I'm just not good enough. Like, I can't hit the ball as far as these guys. And we always say, like, the hardest part about golf, professional golf, is that you have to fire yourself. In other sports, you know, you get the coach and he taps you on the shoulder. He's like, sorry, you're cut. But in golf, you kind of got to look in the mirror and be like, man, do I have, and every golfer will tell you, like, I'm one shot away. And they really believe that. And they should believe that. But unfortunately, some players just realize it quicker than others. And, you know, I also think that players that play our tour, they come out here, and especially first year players, and maybe they don't really know how competitive it is, and they see how competitive it is. And it really opens their eyes to say, like, wow, like, can I compete at this level? But there's also, like, I was talking, not to be a name dropper, but I was talking with Tom Lehman last week. His son is an aspiring young pro, and his opinion on it was that if you think you have what it takes and you have the means necessary to pursue your goal of getting to the PGA Tour, then you can do it, which I thought was a really interesting perspective. And I've gotten to know Tom a little bit through, he's the honorary chairman for our event in Brainerd because he's from Minnesota. And, you know, if you guys can ever get a chance to have Tom on your show, like, very thoughtful and has a lot of really good thoughts on golf and very articulate, and really enjoy Tom's perspective on things.
Yeah, and he obviously has a lot of life experience of working his way up to the tour. I know John Haim, Kevin Haim's brother from Ottawa, he was a roommate with him. They used to play the South African tour together. So this is a guy who really has got a lot of perspective of working his way up through the smaller tour. So he understands the whole process. You mentioned that, you know, in talking about players of coming up. One thing that has been continually successful for you guys has been the qualifying school. And the demand for that has been unbelievable. I don't know if people realize how fast it also sells out, people trying to get in there. But why don't you have some comments a little bit about the demand and how much guys want to be on that tour?
Yeah, so we actually changed the way that players can now enter Q School. And it's to your point, Scott, is that there was so much demand from players that we didn't have enough spots to accommodate everybody. And to your point, the guys had to go on their computer at 12 PM and basically it would sell out. I think the record was like under 2 minutes, it would sell out. And so guys are having bandwidth issues and there's guys in Australia that are waiting at the middle of the night to try and sign up. And so this year, what we did is we essentially did, we opened Q School for a week. Anyone that wanted to enter could enter. Originally, we had 6 sites planned, and we had an overflow site in case we had more demand for players, and we ended up using that overflow site. So this year, for the first time, anyone that entered Q School had a chance to tee it up. In that process, it wasn't perfect, but it worked well. And, you know, we'll constantly evaluate the way that we have that. We do the Q School signup process. But I think we, if you talk to the players that did go through the process, they would say it was good. In terms of the demand, I think that speaks to what we've built with this tour. And I think what happens is that college coaches, players that are friends with PGA Tour players or Korn Ferry Tour players, agents in particular, they're at, hey, where should I start my career? And by and large, those individuals and what I would call key influencers in someone's career are pointing them in our direction. And obviously we're flattered by that. And we try to do as best we can to provide them an opportunity to grow their game and learn. And, to date, I think we've done a pretty good job.
think you have. So what we're going to do, just kind of wrap up a little bit, we're going to ask you to take off your executive director hat for a little bit, and we're going to put on your Scott Pritchard hat. And I know there's a couple of things that are sort of near and dear to you, but we want some sort of suggestions to maybe help out our listeners. I know you're a big music guy. Give us two bands that people don't know about that they should go see live or at least listen to.
That's a good one. So right now I'm on to a band called the Drive-By Truckers. They're like a Southern, I want to say like rockabilly sort of country rock. And I'm really digging those guys. And then actually a former bandmate of theirs, his name's Jason Isbell. And he's got his own solo career going, and I've started to get into him as well. Kind of a side note, I was never really much of a country fan, but my wife, being from a small town, you guys are familiar, big country yes. fan, and so she's gotten me into country. So I'm kind of broadening my musical horizons, but I'm still like my favorite band in I would say in the modern age is the National. A huge fan, and I know you probably follow RT. We've been to a few concerts together, and so yeah, I would. They're probably my default band that I would listen to, you know, when no one else, I had no one else to listen to, or I couldn't think of. But I also like, you know, classic rock, and I, you know, in high school I listened to a lot of like punk rock, and so from time to time I'll still throw that on.
All right, you know what? Golf, music. We got to wrap it up at the 19th hole. You're a craft beer guy. Got to know about two breweries or two beers that we need to know about.
Well, again, going near and dear to your heart is I'm a big fan of Stone City in Kingston. Whenever I get to Kingston, I'm like, it's one of my first stops. My wife doesn't, she's like, we're going to the brewery, right? I'm like, oh yeah. The Uncharted IPA there is one of the best. And one that I can't necessarily get my hands on that much, but it's Sleeping Giant Brewery in Thunder Bay. They have an American IPA called Hop It, which is, in my opinion, the best American IPA in Canada. But it's hard to get. Like, you can't get it in Ontario. They do have some of their other beers available at the LCBO. And then just for good measure, my go-to Toronto beer would be Great Lakes Brewery. They have a number of really good IPAs, and actually they're partnered with our good friend Jeff Tate as well. He brews Triple Bogey out of there. So awesome. There's three for you.
Awesome. Well, we really appreciate that. We really appreciate your time. Good luck with everything in your new position, and obviously with getting the schedule together. And we thank you for coming on Tea Talk.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. And great job with the show, and keep it up.
All right. Thank you, Scotty, for that great interview. We appreciate it. We're looking forward to the McKenzie tour coming back, and we're thinking of all those tour pros that, you know, this was their year to start out on the McKenzie tour. We're keeping them in our thoughts. We hope they get their first full year on the McKenzie tour, because it's a grind to even just get there. It sounds like they have a plan. They talked about, you know, the plan changes every single day, just like everything else. But we're excited to have that back along with all the other professional tours. We've been doing this for the last couple of weeks. So we've been talking about we've been rating golf clubs and our top five favorites of, you know, we did our top five favorite TaylorMade irons a couple of weeks ago. We did our top five favorite putters of all time a few weeks prior to that. And this week we decided we're going to go down the ping lane, and we're going to do our top five ping irons of all time. You can clearly tell we're iron nuts. We love looking at some nice sets of irons. I mean, they take up the most of the bag, so it makes sense.
We're equipment geeks. Yeah, really.
Exactly. And ping's been around forever, so why not do ping? And I mean, I think it's only fair that you got your ping. Your ping history book here, the size
all 9 pounds of it.
All 9 pounds. I was just about to plug my 2014 Fitter of the Year for ping, but I won't because of your giant book. So we're each going to give five. I'm sure we're going to have overlap. And Scotty, why don't you start it off on your favorite so far?
Yeah, I'm going to go all the way to the back, which, you know, all the way to the early history of Ping, their first set of irons, which were produced in 1961. It's the Ping 69 irons. And here's kind of a funny thing. So the 69 irons, a lot of people thought the irons came out in 1969, but that was actually referring to the possible score that you could shoot with them. So the Ping 68 irons actually came out after the 69s. But basically what happened was Carsten Solheim wanted to get into the iron game, looked at getting some forged heads from another foundry that he knew, Golfcraft. And then basically he worked with himself and his son, and they milled out some cavities on the back and they built a forged iron. So, you know, really distinctive. I've managed to have a couple of these sets in my hands over the years. Really, really hard to find, of course. You know, some collectors have had them at, you know, PGA shows and different shops and things like that. But really, this is the roots of Ping getting into iron. So it had to be on my list, the Ping 69.
I like it. I'm going to go down a different road, and I'm sure we'll meet together at some point here. But the Ping Rapture was the first one on my list. And this is kind of their original game improvement design that you see where their designs have gone from. If you look at, say, you know, the G30 or their current G410s and all those, you can see where it came from. If you go back to the Rapture, the Rapture V2s were great as well. And just, you know, they have that I'm failing to call it. I'm going to call it the medallion on the back that they actually
custom tuning port.
Yeah, the tuning port where they actually that glued in there is how they adjust the swing weights on it. And a lot of people, I remember so many times people would come in and to get their golf grips done, and they would be missing that. And like, do you find you struggle with this club? And like, yeah, it just doesn't feel right. It's like, because you need this piece. And the best part about Ping is you could call them up and they would find that piece and they get that sorted out for them, even with these original Raptors. So it was really cool that they came out with that design. And I might be wrong that this wasn't the original, but you know, I think when you look at that and you see where they went from there, it's a true innovator for the rest of their lines going forward.
Yeah, I think that one came out in around 2007. I would definitely say it was a key stepping stone to a lot of the technologies and things they introduced afterwards. So I would say it's certainly fair to call that sort of a, you know, a key point in their game improvement category for sure. Second one for me, I'm actually going to dip back into the forged iron market here. Ping came out with the Answer iron in 2011, which was their first forged iron that they'd had in over 40 years. It was a little large for me, but I liked the concept of it. I liked the feel of it. It wasn't just a single, you know, kind of a blade shape. Had a tungsten nickel sole, so it had a lot of mass on the bottom. And then there was actually an internal cavity. Well, I won't call it an internal cavity. I call it a hidden cavity that displaced about 30 grams of weight to the outside. And I was excited to see a forged club come back for Ping. Not necessarily saying that, you know, a cast club is, you know, not quality, because obviously they made tons of great ones over the years, but I just thought it was intriguing and sort of a milestone for them to dip back into that forge market.
Yeah, I remember when those came out, it was a kind of a shock for sure. And I think for a lot of people, when they thought forge, they think of you know, the Mizunos, and that's where they would go. And these ones I don't remember really selling off the shelf that much back in the day. And I remember after a few years later, you could get some really good set of these brand new for a really good price, just because people didn't know how good the club was. And they actually did a remake of them afterwards. They did a 2013 version, which were great. And then, you know, they took a break from the forge clubs up until recently. For me, my second one is the S59 Tour. This is a club that, you know, Bubba Watson used forever. It was kind of that first blade-like design that Ping ever made. You know, they were popular on all the tours. It took a long time for people to switch. You know, after this, they came out with whatever the 58s or the 57s, and people still stuck with the 59s. And you know, I remember you going to pro shops back when they came out, and all the pros that played Ping all had them. Great classic design. I'm a fan of them, and clearly Bubba was, because he hung on to those things for dear life.
Yeah, he did. And that was, you know, that was one for me as well. That was going to be my third one. The 59 Tour came out in 2005. It had actually evolved from the original S59, which came out in 2003 at the Open Championship. The neat part with the Tour model, not only was it a little bit smaller, but it actually had a ferrule, which was something that, you know, Ping irons weren't known for. So that was kind of interesting. They came back, but you're right. They kind of had that thin top line. They had a cavity with the custom tuning port, and it really was a big stepping stone for them in the better player market.
Yeah. And the club that, you know, in a lot of people's minds really replaced it. Yes, they came out with the 57, they came out with the 56. For me, the S55 is what really replaced it for a lot of people, including Bubba Watson. And I think he might even still be playing them at times. Like, he kind of goes back and forth with these. And then, like, they have the iBlade now, which is out, which is kind of the replacement for the S55. But still, I love these S55s. They were that first, you know, players club that were really easy to hit. You didn't feel like you were losing distance. They were thin, just a good solid design. I would say, you know, probably their best players club they made up until the Blueprint, which just came out. Didn't make my list, but a beautiful golf club nevertheless. But I love the S55. I'm still looking for a set. It's one one of those sets that you know, you regret selling, even though, you know, it's just a classic design for me. Maybe it's not a classic design for forever, but for me, it's just one of my favorite set of irons I ever owned.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've talked about that a little bit on the podcast. We might have to do a whole podcast on regret sets, really more than anything. But number four for me, you know, Ping was really known and got really known for their irons when the Ping i2 came out. And it wasn't just the Ping i2 that was the popular one for me or the one that caught my attention. It was the Brillium Copper version of it. And these really became sort of a cult classic more than anything. We talked about Michael Jordan and The Last Dance. There was actually a scene in there where he's playing golf with Scottie Pippen that I noted. Those are the irons that are actually in his bag at the time. And whether it was, you know, Tiger Woods with a lob wedge playing out of it, or Mickelson, I mean, there's a lot of people that have played around with these irons over the years. Players like Mark Calcavecchia made them famous when he was playing with them as well. But what happened was Carsten Solheim had experimented a little bit with the material when they had their K1 irons. He made about 11 sets or so back in the mid 70s. And, you know, it's a heavier weight material, and copper is obviously super soft, but they use the beryllium to firm it up. And so it gave it kind of some neat characteristics. So they developed these irons in November 84 is when I dug into the history book and found out. And it was just supposed to be a limited edition at first. And they had that, like I said, that very unique feel, non-glare finish. And then really from there, what happened was they were more expensive than the regular i2s. And they thought, oh, well, you know, because they're more expensive, people are not going to buy them. But boom, everybody loved the look. It just became something that was really a had to have item, especially in that, you know, mid late 80s. And as a result of it, I had to put it on my list.
Yeah, so that was my on my list as well. It's just an all-time classic Ping. I think when I think Ping irons, it's the first one I think of. It was actually my fifth one, but you got to it on your fourth, so it'll be my fifth. But by fifth, I mean number one, really. I just wanted to save the best for last. And then there's all the stories about why they stopped making them, and, you know, the issues in the factories of, you know, it wasn't actually safe to make them anymore. Yeah. And all those stories, and I'm sure they outlined it in that book. But if you can get a set of those, just keep them in mint condition. You don't need to play at them. They're just such a beautiful club to look at, and so many iron designs afterwards were just almost steals of this design from Ping. Any of those high toe wedges you see nowadays, it's the i2 back in the day. Maybe not the beryllium copper one, but it's the i2 design you're looking at.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, beryllium, they found out, obviously, for the workers, if they're working away with it and trying to grind it, the beryllium material, not a very healthy thing to ingest. So the state of California put on some limits. They were one of the first places to start putting limits on of people using it from health reasons. Arizona followed as well. So that also made sure that, you know, other manufacturers that were trying to make beryllium products, which there were a bunch more that were trying to do it, they ended up not doing it. And again, cost-wise, a lot of different things. Even though there was a demand for it, eventually they had to stop production of them. So, yeah, unfortunate, but still a cult classic. Still going to find some out there. And it was around that time as well that, you know, with the Ping i2, they brought out that L wedge. And as you mentioned, high toe wedge, you know, they brought the 61 degree L Wedge out, and it became, again, another one of those cult classics where, you know, you weren't a cool player unless you had one in your bag. And, you know, unfortunately, I couldn't afford one at that point, but, you know, all the bags that you sort of admired, they usually had one in them.
I like it.
All right, my last one here, you mentioned a little bit briefly, but the Blueprint Iron. I'm a pretty traditional guy as far as looking at, you know, golf clubs. I like that sort of thin top line, thin sole. The Blueprint came out in just last year in 19. It was really based on requests from tour players for a very traditional blade. Players that really, you know, like to work the ball and hit certain shots in different ways. And, you know, it's a forged iron, but it also has a machined face and grooves. They did a ton of work studying the shape of this iron and how it would work with the players and allow them to hit certain shots. And again, it wasn't for every single player, but players like Louis Oosthuizen and Tony Finau were the first ones to put them in their bag. And that sort of validated for it. Limited sort of run as far as a set is concerned, certainly not for your average player, but certain players that want certain characteristics, it is a really good fit for them. And it was something that was kind of very unusual for Ping based on their track record over the years. So it was welcomed by certain players.
Yeah, it's actually one of their only sets that, I mean, the only set I actually remember, and I've been, you know, working with Ping for a long time, that you actually can't get them off the wall. They don't exist. This is by custom order only, by fitting only, by a Ping certified fitting professional only, because they want to make sure the right players are using these clubs. I thought about using them when I got a new set of irons, and just it's a little too much stick for me. And I think this is one of the coolest things that Ping has done over the years. And my next iron, my last iron I'm going to talk about is the line in between that game improvement and that player's club that I think Ping does better than a lot of folks, and that's the I series line. And for me, it switched over with the I-20. I think it's when it got a little bit thinner, easier to look at. I had a set of I-20s in there. It wasn't super thick. They were easy to hit, but you could still work the ball a bit. You know, you pull out the pitching wedge and it didn't look super thick to chip with. You know, I had the I-20s, I had the I-25s, I had the IE-1s after that. You can see a trend. I had the I-210s, and now I had the eye blade. Like that middle run of those of the Ping lines there is just a great line that they realize that we want that cavity back feel with the forgiveness, almost both, the best of both worlds. And you see that eye line in a lot of players' bags. Lee Westwood, one of those guys that always uses the eye line, and that dated back right to the I-20. I think it took him years to get the I-20s out of his bag because he just loved that those sets of irons. And clearly, you know, we could talk Ping irons all day. We could talk all irons all day. And I'm sure next week we'll bring up another top five. So if you have any suggestions, reach out to Scotty on Instagram. I mean, Facebook if you want. I don't know if people want to reach out to you on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and let us know of some suggestions for what you want us to rank, similar to how you reach out for the mailbag each week. So Scotty opened up the mailbag as per usual this week, got some questions, and he's going to open them up and we're going to answer them.
This episode is brought to you by Adidas and the all-new Code Chaos footwear. Chaos lives here, so you must expect the unexpected and harness chaos. Break free of tradition and drive yourself. Inspire your game with the high-performance design of the Tour Performance Spikeless Adidas Code Chaos golf shoes. Every step is light and energized, each swing secure and confident. Experience Chaos Traction and Twist Grip Hybrid Spikeless Outsole. Chaos is here. Visit adidas.ca to learn more about the all-new Code Chaos footwear.
All right, Scotty, let's hit the mailbag.
Yeah, it filled in pretty quickly this week. I opened it up, and it only took a few minutes to get a bunch of questions in there. So certainly appreciate people, sending those in. Maybe they've got a little bit more time in their hands, and they're thinking about golf a little bit more than playing it right now. But let's start with an interesting one. Do you think that with people unlikely to travel as much, there will be a resurgence in popularity for more local and regional golf events?
So I'm going to assume they mean by playing in them, or if,
yeah, for sure.
I mean, playing, if it's playing in them, then yes. If it's like people going out to watch a bunch of stiffs out there, it's a clear no. But yeah, no, I think that's, it's going to make you know, fields like the Flagstick Open, which is coming up in August. And if you haven't signed up, head to flagstickopen.com and sign up. We're probably going to see a very deep field for that this year from the local players in the area, just because they probably aren't going to be traveling to the States to play in, you know, USGA events or, you know, what other events they have down there going on, and trying to keep it local. So I think it will. It's going to make it fun to play against those players. But yeah, no, it should. I hope so. I hope so. I hope people are keeping as local as possible.
Yeah, I think it was sort of timely to get that question in, because I'd just done a post on the Kawartha Invitational in Peterborough, Ontario, and they're having their 75th anniversary of that tournament. And it sort of prompted a discussion amongst a bunch of other people talking about the Invitational circuit and how important those events used to be, and how a lot of the two-day events at some clubs and stuff sort of went away over the years. And it was interesting to note people's nostalgia for those events and sort of a desire that to maybe play those. So it played right into that. The other side as well is when we start to look at things like junior golfers, you know, it sort of became, you know, the sexy thing of to try and go and play these big tournaments as much as possible. But if that's not an option, they're going to have to stay a little bit more local and maybe, you know, learn to play well, even on the local circuits. And I think, you know, I think this listener's right on the mark here. I think you probably will see a resurgence in some playing at those events. All right, here's another one. This is interesting. I'm really curious to hear your take on this one. Most birdies you've made in a round that you didn't break par. These are always some interesting rounds, that's for sure.
Yeah, so this happened last year, actually. I remember it like it was yesterday. So I had 6 birdies in a round and didn't break par. So I was 73 and a par 72. And it came down to 18. All I needed was a par on 18 to shoot even par. So I needed a birdie. And it's a par 5, and it's a short par 5 at my home course at a Loyalist Golf and Country Club. So good drive, good second shot, and I'm green side in 2 on a par 5, which for me is you know, I'm not a long hitter. For me, is always good. So let's say it was 15 feet to get up and down to shoot 71, which is, you know, for me, as I said, I'm, you know, somehow going between like a 3 to a 7 throughout the year, depending how much I'm playing. And I was playing pretty well. So in short game, and putting is usually my thing. And so I'm like, all right, easy up and down. I got this. No. So I flubbed the chip. And I said, like, I was 10 feet and I'm a little bit short-sighted, and I'm still short-sighted.
Were you thinking about this as you were doing it? Were you aware of what your score was?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Everyone that says they aren't, they're lying to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, of course I was. So I'm thinking, I'm not thinking that. I'm thinking, like, chip in 70. Nice, right? Like, one of my lower rounds it would have been my lowest round on a par 72. So
yeah.
Flubbed the chip. So now I'm short. And I'm like, so I got to chip this in now. And I'm like, in the rough, and it's a little thick. They had a tournament coming up, so I try again to this time I'm going for the chip, and I go for the chip and I blow it past. I ended up making a bogey clearly on it from literally 15 feet away. Shoot 73, 6 birdies on the round.
Wow.
Including the 2 previous holes. So like I was rolling, and yeah, it was a rough finish, let's say that.
I can't really think off the top of my head as far as the birdies, but as soon as I saw this question, one round that I had jumped out right away, because it's one I've referenced a number of times. And Smuggler's Glen Golf Club, which is another one not far from us, is a golf course that I played one time and had 3 eagles in a round and did not break par. So started with
that. Can happen out there though, you know, those trees can get narrow. They start to squeeze in soon.
Yeah, we should say that this golf course is a very risk reward. Has a lot of open rock faces, a lot of trees, as you mentioned, has some narrow tee shots. So it's one that you can be aggressive, but you can also make big numbers, which obviously I did. So I made a eagle on the 4th hole. I chipped in for eagle on the 8th, which is another par 5. And then I managed to drive the green on a hole they called the Gambler, which is only about 270 yards up a hill, but, you know, fraught with disaster. And I think it was a hybrid or something downwind to reach it. But I think I ended up shooting about 74 on the day. And that included an 8 on the 18th hole, which is another massive par 5 with the lake. And I was overly aggressive. Got thinking in my mind, oh, I'm in position here. You know what? I'm not really worried about the score. I think, you know what? Maybe I can make 4 eagles in a round. Got greedy and got spanked. Mm-hmm. So, you know what? It was kind of funny afterwards. And obviously, the guys I was playing with were going, how did you shoot over par and make 3 eagles? And I'm like, well, you know what? I've got a good story to tell.
Yeah. Now, that 18th hole, you got to stay away from that water, because that water on 18, not because of the golf, there is a snake that lives in that water. That I have seen this thing. Shout out to our buddy Ryan Kennedy, a local former pro in this area, took this picture of this snake. And it was in the middle of their fairway, and they moved it off to the side. This thing has to be 8 to 10 feet long. It is.
Come on.
It's massive. There's a photo of him standing. It's up. Oh, it's on a tree, and he's standing beside it. And I hate snakes. I hate them. If you're out, smugglers, stay away from the long stuff in the water. If you're afraid of snakes, and if you're not afraid of a snake that's like 8 feet long, then you're a freak.
Is this a snake that started at 4 feet and now, as the story gets going over the years?
It's 25 feet long. It's a big snake in the world. Yeah. It's
anaconda.
Yeah, it's an anaconda in Canada.
All right, let's move on to a place where you'll occasionally run into a few snakes is Manitoba. Somebody's got a question here. Have either of you ever played golf in Manitoba, and any courses you can recommend?
I have.
What about you?
I never. If there's a bunch of snakes there, I'm out. I haven't.
there are.
I can't even tell you the last time I'd been in Manitoba. Pretty long, long time ago. So no, I have not played golf there, but I'm sure you have.
Yeah, just to make you shiver a bit, I'll tell you to maybe Google it afterwards. But I lived in Saskatchewan for a bit as well, and then traveled a bit through Manitoba. And you can look up some of these nests of these big garter snakes and stuff that are in the prairies, and you will probably freak out just by having a look at them. Have not played a lot of golf in Manitoba. Certainly want to get to Winnipeg and play some of the great golf courses there at some point.
Oh, I shouldn't have Googled that right now. Sorry, continue.
The St. George or the St. Charles and Pine Ridges, ones like that. But two that I can recommend are the Hecla Golf Course and Falcon Lake, which are both were provincial golf courses, and now they're run by a separate management company. But Hecla is about 2 hours north of Winnipeg. Looks like they have a beautiful resort there now. Was not there when I would have visited. Right on Lake Winnipeg, some great views, solid golf course. Falcon Lake, you'll find it's about an hour or so just outside of Winnipeg. Great spot in a provincial park. Quality golf course, I think close to 7,000 yards. Looks like they have a new clubhouse. I looked it up, but a fun place, for families as well. Not only do they have a quality golf course, but, they've got a mini golf course there as well and stuff like that. So, if you're going there as a public player and you're passing through Manitoba, there's definitely those two I would definitely recommend. Are you freaked out now?
Yeah, I didn't like that. Snakes? I didn't like that. I don't know what you said after I looked at that photo, but I'm sure the listeners are going to appreciate it.
All right. Got 3 more left here. If given a choice, would you prefer to be a great amateur player or an unsuccessful tour player?
That's an interesting one. So this is an easy question. A great amateur player, you know that you're losing money because you're paying to play in these tournaments. A professional player doesn't believe they're losing money, and they just lose money. So if I know I'm just going to be paying, say, whatever to play a tournament, and if I'm a great player, I'm sure I'm picking up, maybe like a golf membership, passes, free irons. Yeah, give me that over the guy that just pays a bunch of money to play small professional events and just loses and is away from home all the time and lives in their car.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically saying, do you want to be a good player, like you said, maybe picking up some stuff at an amateur event, or do you want to be a donor?
Do you want to be a good player or a delusional player?
Yeah, I think part of the issue here for a lot of people is maybe, if they're... you know, ego might say, hey, I want to be a tour player or whatever the case may be. But, you know, I don't think anybody wants to go out there and play poorly if you're a competitive golfer. So easy one for me as well.
I'd rather at the end of the day, I get the question because like nowadays, like you think back, you can name, you know, hundreds of these great amateur players from way back in the day, right? Like in the 50s and 40s, whatever. Nowadays, no one remembers the amateur player. It just doesn't matter. Like if you're that good, you don't stay amateur, you end up going professional. It just, you know, what would be the point at this point? So now, like, I get the question of it, and if it's actually like I'm really, really, really good, and you know, if there's, then go try to be pro. It doesn't really matter. But like for me, if I know I'm not going to be successful being one thing, I already did that. Like I was an unsuccessful musician living in a van. I don't want to do that. playing golf now too.
Yeah. I think the thing is here now is that, you know, there's been such a proliferation of mini tours in the last, you know, let's say 40 years that it's gave the opportunity for a lot of people to go out and try their hand at professional golf where, you know, there was more limited spots back in the day and the timing that you're talking about, the 40s, 50s, whatever. So there is very little chance that you know, unless you were really good, you wouldn't bother and go do that. So I think that's an easy one, and I think we're both on the same page there. So so let's move on. All right, speaking about our golf abilities, what's the most amount of money you have lost in a golf match?
That's I don't know, like
do you want to answer that one or no?
Quarantine, folks. No, I'm just kidding. I have not lost that much play. I don't play.
Is your wife listening to the podcast?
Yeah, she's at the door of the office listening. No, I don't gamble too much when playing, like maybe $100 in a day. I want to still enjoy the round at the end of the day, and for some, like $100 could be all the money in the world to them, and for others it could be nothing. And so like I like the idea of sweating it. It's more the competition than anything, that it puts something on the line and keeps you engaged until the end. So yeah, I'm not like, I hear guys, you know, playing member guests with $10,000 on the line, and they're, you know, now they're fighting over handicaps and things like that, and I'm not about that, right? Like, you know, let's give it up. We're not, like, it's just silly. You know, I may be a degenerate, but I'm not that big of a degenerate.
Yeah, I'm the same. You know, don't really gamble for too much out there. I'll play for a little something or whatever, but generally it's like a beer after the game or something like that. You're playing more for pride more than anything. But I would say, though, back in the day, playing in a pro-am, I got rooked into a team game at one point where it was a Canadian tour event, and our team was, we had Patrick Moore, who ended up being a pretty solid player on the nationwide tour. And our team was playing against Steve Scott, who lost the U.S. amateur to Tiger Woods. And we had a little match going. Of course, I had no idea what we were playing for. All I know is I had X amount in my pocket, and I had to go pick up another $200 at a bank machine afterwards. So make sure you know what you're playing for before you press or say anything on the 18th tee, especially when you're meddling with tour pros.
Or you understand the game too, right?
Yeah, like, that too. Yeah, exactly.
Because that's a whole other problem. I personally like bets where it's not necessarily money related. Like you and I made a bet, and it luckily never had to come true, where one guy had a caddy for the guy if it did come true and things like that. And usually those type of bets come up the night before when you're on like a boys trip and it's late at night and you're drinking and someone says something silly, and now the next day you have this insane bet going on and both of you can barely see the golf ball anyway. So those are the ones I prefer to talk about, like who has cooked dinner, who's got to clean up the tab the next night. Those are way more fun.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. And really, even on trips and stuff like that, it certainly can cause a divide. I can remember a Pinehurst trip where we had a spreadsheet and we were going to play, you know, all the golf courses at Pinehurst, and we were keeping the spreadsheet with the matches and who owed what. And, you know, by the time it got to the end, and I'm not going to say who the people were involved, but I know there was one player that was chucking clubs and whatever, and it wasn't me. You know, it was all upset and wouldn't talk to the other players. And, you know, that's just not fun. So you're right. You know, keep it reasonable, and you know, they are your golf buddies. Try and keep them your golf buddies. It's a lot better to you know, enjoy yourself out there rather than fighting over something that's not really necessary. All right, last one here for the week. What current LPGA player would you like to play a game of golf with?
Oh, for me, this is actually real easy. It's Angel Yin, because it would be so humbling. Yeah. So humbling. This girl hits bombs and she's hilarious, and I think we'd have a blast, and she's just a fun person to talk with, and I try to catch up with her every once in a while on Instagram, and she's a very funny follow on Instagram. We're huge Brooke fans here. I would play golf with Brooke any day of the week she calls. If she wants me to head up to the Westport Golf Club and play with her, I'm there. But if you're giving me one pick right now, it's Angel Yin for sure.
Yeah, I think that trio of Angel Yin, Tiff Joe, Jane Park, all three of those golfers are hilarious. And you know, Angel, obviously, with the ability to blast the golf ball. And people should go back.
Drive me by 50 yards every hole. It would be so humbling.
Yeah, and if you're not familiar with Angel Yin, you should go back and she was a guest on the podcast, and you should go and listen to that. But you'll see what her personality is like. She was amazing that way. I would probably, you know, I was leaning that way and looking at the players like that. You know, you mentioned Brooke. I've never managed to play a full round of golf with Brooke, and I've known her since she was a little kid. So I think maybe that might be fun to finally do that and you know, play 18 and play a match, play a game, get my butt kicked, but have a lot of laughs and be able to, you know, take some time to reminisce of a lot of things over the years, a lot of tournaments, a lot of coverage, a lot of, you know, discussions over the years, a lot of mutual friends. And I think that just would be kind of entertaining more than anything. All right, that wraps it up. That's our mailbag for this week. As Stefan said earlier, you know, make sure you submit your questions to us. You can get at us on Twitter at @flagstick or Instagram at @flagstickgolf. And certainly, you know, we'll take your questions and we'll try to answer them as best we can.
And we got to wrap it up with our usual tip of the week from the pro, Scotty. I know, I think this is a good time to check in with your pro regardless. I know golf isn't really happening, but check in with your pro. And luckily mine's here every single week looking at me through this Zoom room. So what's the tip of the week this week, Scotty?
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of people online working on different things. But a lot of times, too, though, they'll jump in and just grab a tip and then start trying to do stuff. But my tip of the week is basically, you know, you've got to really consider things that happen with your body and your physical limitations and ability first before you're trying to do things with your golf swing. One thing that I try to do with people all the time is to make sure that I know what their medical history, their physical history is, and things that could provide some limitations. There are some medical screenings, some protocols that can be done. Titleist Performance Institute obviously offers one called a TPI screening. You should really go and have this sort of done and to find out what your body is capable of doing and not capable of doing. A lot of people have limitations, and if your instructor doesn't take this into account, they could be asking you to do something that you cannot do, that you're just physically not capable of. And really, you know what? You shouldn't be taught from a model. You should be taught for you of what you're doing and what you're capable of and what your body is capable of doing. So consider getting a TPI or a medical screen before you're going to take some lessons. And even if you're taking some lessons now, you can still go back and do that, but bring that information to your coach, to your instructor, let them know kind of what limitations you have, and then they can work around that.
I love it. I love it. I'm dealing with some hip issues lately. I don't know, maybe it's just sitting too long, and I've been trying to roll those out, and I started running earlier this week. I don't know why, and now my hammies hurt. So
Zoom insanity, probably. Yeah, too many online meetings.
I don't know. I'm losing it. But that's it for this week, folks. We really appreciate it. As I mentioned during the mailbag, it's a good reminder to head to flagstickopen.com and sign up for the tournament taking place in August. We'd love to have everyone play. You announced on Twitter and on Instagram the package you get just for signing up, which is well over the entry fee, and shout out to Adidas and TaylorMade for coming together on that package. I can't wait for the tournament, and I just can't wait to play golf again. So hopefully next week when we get back with you all, we'll be announcing some plans to be doing that in Ontario. And if you are one of the lucky folks out there playing, we hope you're enjoying. Tell us some stories. Give us some stories of what's going on with these new rules and different ways. Or, you know, have you got a fake hole in one by hitting the cup? And we want to hear these type of stories, because we'd love to break them down and talk about, you know, what golf is, you know, the future of golf, because we're in this new normal now, and maybe this is the new normal. Maybe from here on out for a long time, the cups are raised, and we just got to get used to that. So reach out to us. We'd love to hear the stories. But until till then, thank you for listening. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Rate us on whatever platform you're listening to. And we will chat with you next week.
Slow motion in a day like today, my boat's lost in the ocean. Have enough.